This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I'm talking to Bill Schubart, the author of a novel called Lila and Theron, T-H-E-R-O-N, in case I'm not pronouncing it clearly. A beautiful, slim novel that I really think highly of. How are you, Bill?
I'm good. It's good to be with you.
Yeah, really, it's fun to do this. You know, we've known each other a long time, but this, you know, you've done many different things in your life. And this is, of course, not your first book, but is this your first published novel?
Well, it all depends on, you know, what you mean by published. My first collection of short stories came out on a very, very small press, which is no longer with us. And they did a very good job, sold, I think, probably 4,000 or 5,000 copies. And then, sales tapered off and they sort of were slowing down, and I bought the rights back and republished, under my own publishing. I self-published it. And then the next five books that I wrote, I self-published also. Two more collections of short stories and then three prior novels. But this is the first book that has been picked up by a traditional publisher. So in that sense, yes.
Well, it is... You live in Vermont, and you've been there, you've lived there most of your life. This is a book that's set in Vermont and, but very, covers a lot of time. And I thought of these two characters who are, the main characters of the book and wondered, because they are so, I mean, you basically take them through their lives in Vermont during a period of great social and cultural change, which is, you know, the 20th century, essentially.
Yeah.
Are they based on any particular people, or are they really a kind of amalgam of lots of different people you've known kind of made into characters?
More the latter than the former. The genesis of this, interestingly enough, my sister works in a small, Northern Vermont hospital as head of social services. And every once in a while, she'll call me up and she'll say, you know, you won't believe this. And she called me one night and she told me this story. And I was so taken by it, I stayed up and wrote it into a short story and sent it back to her. And said, is this right? And she said, yeah, it's pretty much it. I mean, obviously, she was paying great attention to patient privacy and mentioned no names. And I fictionalized the whole thing based on the base story. And that short story became a lot of people's favorite short story in that collection. And people would ask me about it. So I simply just decided to imagine the backstory of this couple. And the reality is, a person not named Theron lived in, you know, that wilderness in Vermont, with his wife, not named Lila, and, actually died just 9 years ago.
Hmm. And so those are the inspiration. Those two people are the inspiration. So, I think the idea of this, it's hard to, you know, I want to talk about it without kind of doing a setup so that someone who might be interested in this book would understand what it's about. And so you have these two people who grew up individually in this kind of hardscrabble communities of rural Vermont in the early 20th century, mm-hmm. Which has probably more, that period in rural America might be more connected to the 19th century than people living today would be able to understand. I think, you know, you kind of set them. I mean, they are farming with horses. Mm-hmm. And I think I remember when I first came to Vermont in the early 1970s, there were still a few old-fashioned traditional farmers working with horses.
Absolutely.
But that's, you know, that's such an old way of farming. It's hard for people to realize that it was possible to operate farms on such a small scale that you could do it with animals.
Well, what to me was so striking, and this sort of in some ways goes to the cultural changes, not just the sort of technical changes in agriculture, but the cultural changes. I mean, it's I don't know how to describe it, but as new technology in farming kept coming in, a lot of people were really wedded to the way they had farmed for a long time. And, you know, whether it was being connected to their land or connected to their animals, not everybody rushed to go out and buy a new baler or a new tractor or, you know, a new skidder if they were logging. A lot of people were very content with what they had. What always strikes me in retrospect, David, is that a lot of the hill farmers that I knew in Vermont actually made a reasonable living for that time, or I should say more accurately, created a reasonable lifestyle for themselves by milking 25 cows.
I know, it's so shocking.
I know, a farm in Vermont now cannot survive without milking at least 300.
Right.
And there are farms in Vermont now that are milking 3,500.
Right. No, when we were there most recently on South Hero, one of the local people told us about, there's one guy on South Hero who's been buying up all the farms. He's a farmer. As many of the families no longer want to live that lifestyle, the hard work of being a small farmer, what you have is the reason that the farms get larger. It's not just the efficiency. It's that only a few of the farmers are left. And the ones who are left consolidate because they're smart enough to realize that they can do it. But they're working on a different scale then. But it's not like the Midwestern farms, you know, with thousands of acres, but it's a kind of New England equivalent, you know, where you might have hundreds of acres.
Though, and I know you don't want to get lost in farming, but even the huge farms are struggling. Americans drink 25% less milk. And there's no market for all this milk. And it's a real issue because, I mean, as the hill farmers began to fade out and didn't want to work as hard as they did to make a living off of 25 or 50 cows, the people milking 500, 1,000, and 2,000 are now in the same position, which is bizarre.
Right. No, that is anyway. No, but that's, I think it's important to, because that's the backdrop of, you know, kind of takes you back to an understanding of what this story is about, that it could not happen today. This is a story that is a historical novel in a certain way, even though the history is fairly recent. And I think it's important, you know, it was very striking. I found this book very evocative and emotional to me. It was full of beauty and sadness at the same time. Part of the sadness is in recognizing that a certain kind of life that people could have is very difficult for anyone to replicate today. But also another part of this that was powerful for me is that you humanized people who are often either typecast or even not recognized, in modern culture, that you, you know, you've given them reality, a place, a voice, and a beingness that I thought was really, really important.
Well, that's of course always what, you know, any writer wants to hear is that, and in reality never knows for themselves. We used to joke when we were young, somebody would say, I'm a poet. And we'd say, well, no, you're not. And they'd say, well, what do you mean? And say, well, you're not a poet till someone else says you're a poet.
Right. Well, there is that idea of, you know, and it's a kind of interesting thought experiment that if you are an individual artist or writer, you can be yourself without reference to the larger world.
Right.
But you know, that then you have to wonder, what does it mean if no one experiences your art except yourself? And then, but there are people who are perfectly happy because their art is satisfying to themselves. It does the job for them that they need, and they don't care whether it they're validated, you know, by that shared experience. But I think most
that's absolutely true.
But it seems like I gather, and I would suspect that you would prefer to have the validation.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's always wonderful for a writer to hear that something they've written has meaning for a reader. I think the thing that fascinated me more than anything in writing the book, David, was it was, in fact, the culture, and I never know how to call it. My wife, Kate, who's an editor, often says, now, don't digress into long Latinate words, but I've never found a word that has meaning like the word exigency. And a lot of the people that I knew growing up in northern Vermont, their lives were formed by exigency. I mean, when Lila and Theron got up in the morning, it didn't occur to them to say, well, what should we do today? Or, boy, wouldn't it be nice if we could get that new Motorola radio? The only things they had in mind were, if we don't milk the cows, they'll die. If we don't sell their milk at the creamery, we won't have money to buy sugar, flour, and coffee. If we don't get in, cured wood will freeze to death this winter. If we get wet hay into the barn, it'll burn to the ground. That culture of exigency had a way of forming individuals that seems really in recession in our culture today. You know, the culture of amusing ourselves to death, or the culture of entitlement. And it's not to say that it's black and white, that that didn't exist. But that growing up in an exigent culture where it was immediately in front of you what you had to do to survive, framed a kind of individual that to me is increasingly rare.
I think that's true. And I think that, you know, we recognize that in thinking about the past, that, you know, if you try to imagine what people's lives were like when the majority of their time, not all, but always the majority of their time was devoted to, as you say, survival. It was whether you were farming or hunting or gathering or whatever it might have been, it's a very different day-to-day life. It changes the nature of what leisure means. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, there is a lot of hand-wringing at every stage of human development that the past is being obliterated for a future that one doesn't like. And there is always a danger in over-romanticizing the, as you call it, the exigencies, because, I mean, there are, I mean, and there is that theme in America, I think, ongoing, that the kind of rugged individualist is disappearing. Well, we've been hearing that for the last 100 years.
I know. No, it's... It is the, you're absolutely right about that. I mean, we joke about that with our kids. You know, when I was a kid, this never, you know, well, it's just a function of aging.
Right. But that does not mean that there is not some truth underlying that, and that, you know, the way that one lives does alter the way that one thinks and reflects and potentially experiences. You know, and one of the things I noticed, and I thought about this a lot, that when you were talking about their lives on a day-to-day basis, this sort of, you know, the get up in the morning and know what you have to do, and the fact that they could live on so little compared to what we think is necessary today, but they had so much less. They, you know, as and this was sort of shocking to me. I didn't realize that so many places in Vermont did not have electricity, for example, until, let's say, 1938 or possibly later.
Yeah, more like 1958.
Right. That's sort of a really amazing thing to think of. And of course, that really does affect your daily life in this really radical way. If you don't have electricity, then there you go to bed on a different, you know, you go sleep at a different schedule than we're used to. But, and so are the, like, when you think about people in Vermont today, you know, and I get this feeling, there is a kind of general thinking that that older generation of people has passed. I just saw today, I think that, Peter Miller, the photographer, is doing another book. He had a book called Vanishing Vermont or something like that.
Well, that's the new book he's doing, and I'm actually in that as a character. In fact, Peter and I are sort of co-promoting our books, at least in Montpelier together, around Vanishing Vermonter. But the interesting term is he uses the participle vanishing, not vanished.
Right.
And as Peter and I have said many times, I mean, we still know people, you know, who live in cellar holes or who live in, you know, crumbling hill farms. And it's funny because traveling around the state, talking to Vermonters, I talk less about the book than sort of what we're talking about. And that is how the culture has changed and how it has not changed. And one thing that comes up repeatedly is the idea of poverty. And it is an illiberal thing to say that poverty is much, much more complex than somebody in the middle class or a wealthy person, how they might envisage it. By which I mean there are people who choose poverty. And I'm not talking about nuns and priests, but I'm talking about people who are so wedded to the land they've lived on and the animals they've lived with, that they don't snap at opportunity all the time. They may make a choice to retain the lifestyle they have, and that may mean, you know, living in a crumbling hill farm or in a, you know, a cellar hole or whatever, but it's a choice.
Right. And I think that is kind of definitional to a lot of the old New England farmscape or, you know, landscape. Yep. That it's not, it's Vermont, but it's also New Hampshire and Maine and probably even parts of Massachusetts. I'm almost sure of that, that definitely, there are people who have made the choice to continue their lives in a style that seems foreign to the modern eye.
Yeah.
And yet it's there. And it's almost like we have two cultures. And I that's probably not a new observation, but there is this sense that there are people in America, many, many people in America, whose outlook is radically different than the kind of general popular, culturally driven, media savvy view. And there, that gulf is extreme now. I think it's, you know, the distance, the social distance is really large now. And I think that's a really big challenge because the depth of mistrust and misunderstanding is quite large.
Yeah, I think you hit it right on the head. And I think what is interesting to me is how the change in culture that we're talking about and the lack of change in culture, as you just said, has created such a staggering division. I mean, we always assume that the division is political. And I think what we're coming to understand in this country is that it's less political and in some cases less economic and more cultural, or even in extreme cases, tribal.
Yes.
I mean, I remember talking to someone from the area where Lila Theron is, lived, and we were talking about the importance of education, and they said, well, of course it's important. You know, I want my children, I want them to go out and I want them to learn to read and write. And I said, and go on to college. And they said, well, you know, I don't know about that. And I said, well, what's wrong with that? And they said, well, you know, then they leave you, you know, and that's a fear.
Well, and it's a reality about, you know, not again, not just in New England, but I think you can see this throughout the Midwest and other parts of the country where you, where kids do go to college.
Yep.
And then they find, you know, it's sort of like that old World War One song, how can you keep them down on the farm once they've seen Gay Paris?
Exactly.
It's really an enticement. I think other cultures and other societies are experiencing it. I think China would say this is a big challenge for them as well, because they have millions of people who are farmers, but they have equally hundreds of millions of people who have left the farm, moved to the cities, because that's where, quote, you know, you would think that's where the action is, you know, that's where the kind of cultural center has moved away from the rural and the farm and has moved now to industry and city.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's like, how do we, literally bridge the gulf of understanding between those two different worlds? And how do you respect the choices that people make, and enable, a kind of cultural chasm to be bridged?
Yes. Yeah.
Now, I could say it'd be really easy to say, well, your book does that, but I don't think that's necessarily true. you know, in a way it is, but that's not, that wasn't, I don't think that was your purpose necessarily. But it does help to understand through art and fiction, you know, the way, but that doesn't solve the problem for the people on the other side of the bridge.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly.
So when you and I know, and you know, I feel like Vermont, being a small state geographically with a small population, it's noticeable how, in some ways it is easy to communicate because people know each other, you know, I mean, it just seems like, you know, everyone somehow knows somebody in another part of the state where they'll have a connection.
Yep.
But have you had experiences yet in, doing public events for this book, or even hearing from people who've read it, who kind of know the communities that you're talking about? And, you know, what is their, how do they react when they read this book?
Well, I mean, Vermont is sort of a microcosm of the country. I mean, when I go to a bookstore or a library and there's anywhere from 3 to 20 people there, there are people who, for whom Lila and Theron resonates experientially. They knew these people too, or they know them today because they're still there. And then there are people who have come to Vermont for a change of lifestyle, for whom this is somewhat of a revelation. They're saying, oh, gosh, you know, this is really interesting. I didn't know about this culture and had no idea that, you know, it really wasn't part of the you know, 19th century or the, you know, the 20th century. And So Vermont has the same sort of bifurcation that the country has. The people who do know Lila and Theron have reacted very, very well to the book. And the people who don't are somewhat curious and generally very full of questions.
Yeah, I think that would make sense. I think that, it's sort of you're in a way acting as a cultural ambassador.
I think that's fair. Or, as somebody said to me at one thing, isn't that cultural appropriation?
Well, okay.
You didn't grow up on a hill farm, which is true. I didn't.
That's
grew
true.
Up in a town surrounded by hill farms, and I went to school with kids, and I played in their silos and their rhubarb patches, but I did not grow up that way.
No, but that I think this idea of appropriation, that's a fair point. I think trying to take someone else's experience and claim it as your own is one thing. But I think writing about an experience of a culture that you're familiar with as a close observer and, kind of part-time participant, I don't think that's appropriation. I think if you pretended that you were this person, that would be different. But
yeah. But I know, I agree.
But I think it's fair to be a loving portrayer of someone whose experience is different from your own, and you're thereby paying homage to them. And I really felt like, this book was it was almost like a love letter, a paean to actual people, without without romanticizing. And I think that's very important. You don't. I mean, there is a certain amount of sentiment that goes into that, but I think you did not, and I think that's a big concern that anyone would have is, it's tempting to romanticize, it's sort of like James Fenimore Cooper, that, and you didn't do that. I think that you gave them life in the fullest sense. And I think that's something to be happy about, and I wouldn't call it appropriation in any way.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. I mean, I didn't take that comment really, really seriously because I have mixed feelings. One of the things that I was so aware of, David, as growing up in a small town in Vermont, was, and this is of course only in retrospect, is that the compression of the human compression of a small town creates and forces a mutual respect that it's centripetal rather than centrifugal, in the sense that people who collide with one another, in stores, in restaurants, in churches, at Granges. That human compression creates almost a dignity and a mutual respect that it honors differing opinions and it honors disagreement, but it forces civility in a sense. And the extreme example of this, which I remember, and most of the people I know who grew up in Vermont remember this, is that small Vermont communities absolutely not only welcomed or left alone or even celebrated, their characters. I mean, the character in our town that everybody talked about, there were a number, but the one that was most vivid to me was a cross-dresser named Crazy Chase. He was a man in his 50s who walked around town, in a dress, with hairy legs growing through his nylon stockings and, falling darts and a pillbox hat, and a big purse that looked like a plumber's tool kit, and yet he was the guy who, when everyone came together at the firehouse to dance, he was the guy who played the fiddle. And he was standing up there dressed as a woman. And I can remember so many stories like this. There was a Down syndrome kid in another town I lived in who every 4th of July, when the parade came through town, he would walk out when it got to the middle of town, and the drum majorette would hand him the baton. And for the next four blocks, he would lead the parade.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't like, oh, look what he's done. Oh, gosh, get him off there. You know, it was just kind of a celebration of him.
Yeah, those are the kinds of things that people really celebrate in small town communities.
Exactly. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think people do that in communities in larger cities as well. They just are less visible in the larger scheme of things.
Yeah, that is.
So do you feel like these characters have you done with them, or now that you've told their story in full, or do they still stay with you and make you think that maybe there's another story to be told about them?
No, I feel like I'm done with them. I mean, I'm not done necessarily with the culture, but I am. I'm done with Lila and Theron, and I've moved on to writing about a whole nother character who is not from that specific culture. So, you know, I don't want to belabor it. And one also runs the risk, if one stays, you know, in one character group, one runs the risk of doing a lesser job in the subsequent. You know, the response to Lila and Theron's been very good. And so it feels pretty complete for me.
Yeah. Well, that's good. Well, I love the book. I thought it was a terrific piece of writing and a wonderful, evocative, and, you know, in some ways, captivating story. So, you know, for a story where it's kind of a small setting, you know, it's not expansive. Mm-hmm. It all takes place in a very small neighborhood, a small geographical area among a small number of people. And I think that was made it really powerful. So
thanks.
Thank you for writing it. I think that was great. So thanks again. Thank you, Bill. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors, and I've been really pleased to be talking to Bill Schubart about Lila and Theron, a Vermont novel that I really recommend.
Thank you very much, David.